And welcome to the Make Do-It-Yourself cast, or as I like to call it, the Make Die cast. I'm Philip Tyrone, associate editor of Make Magazine, your host for the next 30 minutes, and we're going to be talking about hacks, projects, gadget news, and all sorts of interesting things about technology. A couple little bits of housekeeping. This is our first experiment for this type of show. We're going to see how it goes, so we hope that you email us and call us and let us know what you think. We're going to have two different types of audio programs. The first audio program is our interview series, and I've posted about that on the makezine.com/blog section of our site. And basically, it's us running around interviewing people like physicists and scientists and artists and engineers and people just doing all sorts of great things in the maker space. A lot of people from our magazine we're interviewing. And then we have this show, which is just a show that we want to have out a couple times a week about news and all the do-it-yourself projects for the folks that are commuting and driving and just need some audio programs that have something to do with technology, and they happen to like the type of stuff that we do on the Makezine site and in the Make magazine. So let us know how it goes. We're going to have all sorts of ways for you to call in and ask questions and send emails, and I'll get to that later in the show. But let's get started. First up is a story about Elwood Woody Norris. He was just recently named the 2005 winner of the $500,000 Lemelson MIT Prize for remarkable inventions, including the hypersonic sound device that you can actually target sound. I was working on a museum project, and we were evaluating these things, and they're really neat. You can just basically point a speaker at something, and it funnels the sound, so it just it's like a laser beam of sound. And he's also known for his new invention slash device called the Air Scooter, a little single one-person helicopter. Norris got us started inventing and taking things apart, like a lot of us at the age of 8 when he started taking apart radios, and now he has around 47 patents across all sorts of disciplines, which is really interesting that he's been able to do that in his 63 years on the planet so far. The thing I like about his sound invention is it might make the world a little bit quieter. I mean, basically you can start to focus sounds in specific areas, and so all the noise you hear everywhere when you go to the mall or when you go to the grocery store, or all this ambient noise that's everywhere that's just frying our brains over the course of, you know, 50 years or so, you might be able to start using his technology in all sorts of things. So as you're walking down the grocery aisle, maybe you hear the advertisement that's directly targeted at you, that's directly in front of the product, kind of Minority Report sounding, and maybe that'll actually be bad in the long run, but that's just one of the interesting uses that I'm kind of looking forward to. You can imagine having a car with a stereo system where you can have all sorts of different music from the, each person could essentially have their own music station. So they could listen to everything in a car without having to put on headphones, just people in the back get something different than the folks in the front. And then his latest is like the sci-fi dream that you saw in the 50s, everyone having their personal helicopter that you could fly around. Well, this is just a gyroscopic helicopter that he's working on that'll be an ultralight. And for around $45,000 or so, we might be able to have a helicopter that we can fly around and use. I'm not quite sure of the licensing and how that's going to work out, but we have our next issue coming up, which is after the O2 issue, I should say. And I'll read the table of contents for our next issue in a little bit, just to give you guys an idea of what's coming up next. But our third issue is transportation. So I'm going to try to score an interview with them. And man, it'd be great if I can get some flight time on a helicopter, too. That'd be awesome. And speaking of audio, some of you out there have iPod shuffles. And if you're like me, it seems like iTunes is a little bit of a big overhead just to get a couple of MP3s on the shuffle. And I kind of wish I'd be able just to drag over MP3s and that would be it. But I understand sometimes they need to be converted and there's music management and all that. But, you know, what if you have a Linux machine and you use GnuPod or something else besides iTunes? Well, there's a really cool application called the iPod Shuffle Database Builder, and this is a little tiny program that just basically allows you to copy an MP3 onto it. It's a little tiny 8K program, and it allows you to drag it over, you run a little program, and then it rebuilds the iPod database, and that's pretty much it. The link to the program is in the show notes. I found this program really useful, so if you have an iPod Shuffle, I don't think it works with any of the other ones, but use it for the shuffle, and they include the source, and if you're on a PC, there's a binary, and if you're on a Mac or Linux, they have the Python code that you need to run it, and it works great. So that's a little iPod tip from me to you that I found extremely useful if you don't like to open up iTunes every single time just to put one little MP3 on there. Next up, some projects for your digital camera or your cell phone with camera. I posted this up on the Magazine blog, but I'm having a lot of fun with this. I'll post up my results soon. There was a great article on digital photography on the digital photography hacks section of the hack site on O'Reilly, and Todd Oscawara, back from I actually know him from the Pocket PC days, so it was neat to see he's still writing and doing stuff. He wrote a great article about taking shots from your camera phone and making a panorama. And a panorama is just a big old image made up of a bunch of smaller images to get a big wide angle shot. And he suggested the open source Pano tools as one of the photo stitching applications. And I used it, I thought it was okay, but I asked other folks in the community what applications are out there that are free that are useful too. And there's one called Auto Stitch, which is pretty good. And if you look on Flickr, there's Auto Stitch tags, so you can see some of the photos that people made. And by the way, anytime I give a link out in the show, there's always resources and links in the show notes that you can check out later, so no need to rush to a computer quite yet. There's also a program called PT Assembler, which is a Windows helper program for pan tools, and one of the folks wrote in that they were able to make some great shots using that. So these are all little type of little projects that you can do with your camera. I like making 3D photos with my digital camera. That's a fun project. You can also, as we showed in our first issue, you can take a camera and mount it to a kite, and that's a fun one too. There's ways that you can do it with a digital camera where you can just solder in a new chip as a switch, and that's a fun project too. So just getting more use out of your cameras. I was on eBay, and you can get a digital camera, a fairly good one, a couple megapixels, for $30 or so. So if you're thinking about just getting a camera just for playing around and doing all sorts of different projects, this is something. But if you have a camera that you're getting bored with, that just taking regular pictures, these are good weekend projects. If you're gonna go sightseeing or go somewhere, build yourself a little project and take a bunch of shots and then stitch them together later. And you can even make a poster depending on how you shoot the photo, if it's high enough resolution, or you can do all sorts of things. And here's something completely scary but cell phone related. I was sent a link via IRC to a LiveJournal post about someone corresponding with some soldiers over in Iraq about hacking together a solution to avoid those cell phones that are being used to blow up stuff. I saw this photo and heard about the story a while ago, but basically the folks over in Iraq that are blowing up things are using cell phones as detonators. So since they're using cell phones, there's got to be a way to maybe possibly block these things, or to jam them, or to just figure out a way for them not to explode. And the photo that's on the site has a cell phone, and it says one missed call. I guess the trigger didn't go off, so the GI is holding it. And so there's this correspondence that has an interesting exchange between what this hardware hacker is doing and what they're trying to do over there in Iraq. And basically, he's making a radio controller that has an amplifier and a little basic stamp controller that goes through and hops through all 838 possible combination, 22 channels, 38 privacy codes for this specific Motorola family radio that they were using as detonators. So it transmits the code that these detonators would need to be used. So it's this brute force attack to blow up these detonators. And there's some interesting posts that go on about did they use jammers over there, and how do they actually do this? So it's kind of interesting. If these things, if cell phones are going to be used in this way, and there's hardware hackers out there that are interested in helping out, this is kind of an interesting project to step through all of the possible combinations for those radios. And then on the GSM front, maybe you can use some type of jammer or activate all phones or there's something. So do check out this exchange. The link's in the show notes, and check out the picture, the one missed call. I wonder if they called the guy back and said, hey, you know, we're going to come and get you now. And last up on cell phones, this is an email from Brad. Brad said, like the magazine, thanks so much, et cetera, et cetera. Thinking about getting a Windows mobile smartphone. I noticed that you have one too. What type of applications do you have on your phone right now? Thanks. Well, I do have a Windows mobile phone. I have an Orange SPV C500. I think in the US it's the AudioVox phone on AT&T Wireless. And I usually don't install a lot of stuff on my phone, but I do have a few applications on my phone that might be interesting to some folks out there. I do like reading RSS feeds a lot. So I have a few RSS readers. One is called FuseD.RSS, and the other one is just called Smartphone RSS. And I like those. Those are the two readers that I'm using so far. I know you can use NewsGator and Bloglines and web-based RSS readers to read news headlines and such, but I just haven't gone into those. I kind of like having the client on my little device and moving stuff around. I'll probably change that eventually. The other thing that I have on my phone is a couple IRC applications, oddly enough. And I couldn't get all of them to work, but the one that did work was called WMIRC, and that worked out pretty well. The other application that I have, Smart Telnet, it's a Telnet application that I use to Telnet to my Mac, and then I SSH out and log into some secure sites for checking email and things like that. The last application that I have is called iPod or SP, and that allows you to download audio programs like this one or any of the other podcasts out there to your smartphone. It's a little slow, of course, because you have to go over GPRS, but you know, I let it run in the background and it just chugs along, and when I need to, it downloads the podcast. Now, there's another way to do this, which I kind of like to do now that it's free, and I feel better suggesting that it's free. I installed iPodder on my Windows Media Center PC at home. You don't need a Windows Media Center PC to do this. In fact, if you have an XP box at home, this is kind of a neat thing you can do. You can install a program called Orb at www.orb.com, and it's a free application. You install it, and once you install it, you can log into a site called my.orb.com, and what it does is it reaches into your XP machine or your media center, and it exposes all of the things that you can play through a device. Now, the smartphone that I use has a Windows Media Player built in, so what I do is I have iPodder grab all of the podcasts that I want down, and then log into my Orb site, which is connected to the computer at home that has always on access, could be Media Center or XP, and then what it does is it actually streams down the audio programs. Now, for spoken word stuff like podcasts, it's perfect. I don't need to have all of the all the files on my device or keep up storage or anything. So it's kind of a neat solution if you're into those types of things. So I hope that helped out, Brad. If not, you know, feel free to let me know, and we'll help you out. And as soon as I get more applications on this phone, I will let you know. Next up, some science stuff. I wanted to play a little bit of audio from my interview with Brian Green. Now, this interview will come out on our audio series. We're calling it Make Audio for now. But I wanted to play you a little bit. Brian Green authored Fabric of the Cosmos and The Elegant Universe. He also had a great PBS special, and he happened to be in town for an event here in Seattle. And he is probably one of the greatest minds in physics today. Now, this is the year of physics, 2005, celebrating Einstein's discoveries. And you probably notice if you're into these type of things, there's a lot of physics stuff going on this year. So here's a little bit of the interview. I asked him about how the internet has changed how physicists do things, and if he uses Instant Messenger. How has the internet changed the way physicists exchange information, or has it not changed?
It's changed in a dramatic way. When I was a graduate student, we would huddle every Thursday afternoon around the mailroom in order to read the new papers that had been gathered up in the central mail facility at Oxford and delivered to the physics department. Oftentimes, those papers were a month old, 2 months old, sometimes even older than that. Now, every morning, we log on to our own internet archive, and we can see the papers that were posted the night before. So the flow of information is dramatically increased, and in one perhaps unexpected way, it has really brought the world very close together, because it used to be that I would get like a postcard from a physicist in Ethiopia, maybe the lone physicist working on string theory in Ethiopia, asking me if I could just send him my papers, and I would. But who knows how long it would take to get there, and they'd be out of date by the time you receive them. Now he has a computer hooked up to the internet, and he's part of the conversation in real time. And that really is a very important leveling of the playing field for everybody in the world who's working on physics.
So do you, like, have an instant messenger open and, like, instant message Ed Witten and say, like, hey, I just thought of this thing last night, or, like, how does that work out?
Well, I don't have instant messenger open with Ed Witten. I do it with my collaborators who I work with on a more day-to-day basis. And, yes, we go back and forth almost in real time on ideas, thoughts, how to get beyond the previous hurdle that we encountered the day before. So it really does facilitate our ability to make progress.
Neat. So that'll be out soon. And on some other science news, I don't know why I think this story is so neat, but I do. There is some evolution going on with snakes that no one really noticed until recently. And the University of Utah, I believe, has the scoop on this. They noticed that there's this Gartner snake that couldn't eat these newts. Well, it could, but it would die. These poisonous newts. And what happened was these snakes, they mutated, they changed, and now they can eat the newts. So all the snakes that can eat the newts, the population is increasing. They're evolving to a point where they're all, you know, eating the newts, and this food source that was not available before can now be eaten. Now, these newts are super poisonous. They can kill people. Anything that eats them dies right away. Now, an interesting side effect with this, which just cracked me up. So once the snakes got this immunity and they evolved to and adapted to eat these newts, their livers changed a bit, and now birds that eat the snakes die. So the birds are having a hard time with eating these snakes. And also, which is kind of, I don't understand how this works out, but it's just fascinating, the snakes actually have a slightly different color now. There's these red spots on them, so the birds know to stay away. So there's this little interesting microcosm of evolution that's going on, and I had always thought that we needed to see, you know, thousands of years go by, but apparently this is something fairly recent, and I thought that was a neat story. I just like the fact that, so, the snake couldn't eat the newts, could eat the newts. Once he eat the newts, now the birds can't eat the snake, so I wonder what's going to happen next. It's always kind of an ongoing story with science and evolution when you have all these interesting things going on, and that snake must be feeling pretty good about life right now. And next up in science, I got really excited about Bill Nye's new show. It's called The Eyes of Nye, and a lot of people know Bill Nye from Bill Nye the Science Guy, and I was really excited. I had been trying to find the program. I went to the website, I think it's eyesofnye.org, and I couldn't, besides just the one show listing, I couldn't find anything. So you go and eventually I found it after I Googled around, and I used my PBS guide, and I got it, and I set a bunch of recordings. And I really like the show. It's definitely for an older audience. In my area, it comes on at like 2:30 in the morning, and the topics are a little bit more, I'd say, adult-centric than kid-centric, but definitely a great science program. Now, I love all things science, but I wish they would have changed some things on the website. Now, if you go to the website, you'll see what I mean. When you go to the website, there's one link that says View Showtimes. When you click it, it's a little outdated because the showtimes are actually from a while ago. And then when you click Launch Site, there's this big flash window that comes up, and you can't actually download any of the videos, you can't get any text from the notes, but you can see little clips from the show, and here's one about transportation that's kind of interesting, but you can't download it or share it or send to a friend. So I'm going to see if they would consider changing that, because that'd be great for people to be able to subscribe to the videos or the audio or anything, just to get the word out and to take some of this great content and be able to, you know, share and tell everybody about it, because I really think that we need more science programs. And to keep it locked away, and it's just a design thing. They just used FAST is a great tool, but unfortunately, there's no way to directly link to all these things. So hopefully I can convince them to do an RSS feed or something like that. But I really like the show, and that was my only complaint, was I couldn't get to the content, or I couldn't send a link to a specific show that I wanted to tell someone about. So here's the one about transportation.
It's a fuel cell vehicle. This plastic box is the fuel cell. When I throw the switch, it will allow the hydrogen gas to combine with the oxygen to form H2O, water vapor. Now, along with producing water, fuel cells produce electricity. So a fuel cell vehicle is really an electric car with a great battery. When I throw the switch, it'll produce electricity, and off we go. So here's our goal. If we could find a renewable source of hydrogen, we could make getting around a lot cleaner.
And speaking of Flash, and the reason why this was kind of in my mind is that around midnight, I was on IRC and someone said Macromedia and Adobe merged, and I thought it was a joke because I've been doing Flash work and working with Adobe stuff for years, and it's always been like kind of a cold war. Well, at least it was for a while, of these race to the different tools and what company has the better vector technology or whatever. And it looks like Adobe is buying Macromedia, and I'm still in shock. I actually don't know what to think. I'm really pleased. I have tons of friends at Macromedia, and I hope this all works out for them. I actually think it's going to be great, and I think that this is really good, and I think this is going to help the mobile industry, because there's all sorts of questions about SVG and Flash on phones and everything, and I actually think this might be something good. That's at least what I think about now, and it's, you know, shortly after midnight here, so we'll see as this hits the press and the blog world what's going to happen. But yeah, PDF and Flash coming together, who knows what's going to happen with some of the tools. I use Photoshop, but I use Fireworks. I mean, there's going to be some sort of crazy mashup of all these great tools and technologies, and it'll be interesting. I really don't know what's going to happen, and I think that's kind of interesting. The sale price, $3.4 billion with a B, dollars, and it's a full-on stock trade. So if you're someone who makes lots of stuff with these tools, we use InDesign for the magazine, and I use Flash as a design tool a lot of times because I just kind of grew up with it. And I love making little apps for cell phones. And, you know, there's a lot of great things going on with all these companies. There's an Adobe office down the street. All my friends work at Macromedia. So this is just easier. But man, if you're someone who makes stuff, get ready. Something's going to happen. Now, I guess it'll be interesting to see if this gets approved, because there's that. Pesky thing called the government that decides if these things can go through. And, you know, on a side note, it's unfortunate. I kind of think that it would have been neat to see maybe Macromedia put Flash, the vector, the Swift technology, into Longhorn. I don't think it ever worked out for Macromedia and Microsoft to work together on that, but if you look at Adobe and Apple, they've got Quartz, and that's the vector presentation layer on Mac OS X. Would have been neat to see Flash and Longhorn do something, but Microsoft did their own thing. I'm sure there was probably talks behind the scenes or whatever, but that would have been kind of neat to see those types of things. So if you were a Flash developer, you could have made applications that would have been OS-level type stuff. But now, I guess we'll see the vector technology evolve on Longhorn on its own. I think it's called Avalon or something like that, and I guess we'll continue to see all the work that Adobe and now Macromedia does with Mac OS X. So, yeah, neat stuff. And here's one last reader. This is a reader instant message on an email that I got earlier from Tim XOR. And I'll give you all of our contact information at the end so you can send in your voicemails and emails and instant messages. But Tim writes in and says, "Dear Phil, I have a XP laptop that I forgot the admin password for. Is there a way around that?" Well, assuming that you're not trying to do anything evil, I'm just going to assume the best. There's a couple things you can do. There's actually two ways that I know of, and I'm sure other people will suggest other things, and feel free to send them along to me. But there's two ways that I know of. There's one called NT Password, and it's a little boot CD that you can make that will allow you to reset the password of any valid local account on your NTXP system. And it will offer to detect and unlock locked accounts or disabled user accounts. It's pretty much the little disk that I carry around with me for reasons like this. And so that's one way, and there's a link to this in the show notes. The other way actually involves using the Windows setup disk. And the instructions are pretty complicated, But again, I have a link to this in the show notes. So you basically use the Windows, any Windows XP disk, or at least it can be anyone, I'm pretty sure. And you install Windows from the boot disk. You say you want to repair. So if you have a CD-ROM drive that can start up and boot from the disk, you say you want to repair it. And after it goes through the repair process, it'll start to install files. And as soon as it gets to the device section, you actually stop it. And then you put in a couple commands, and you have full control, and you can reset the password to something else. And so those are the two ways. You can always just take XP or whatever operating system that you want to put on there and completely blow out the hard drive or whatever, but I'm assuming that you want to get in and you just forgot the password. This has actually happened to me a couple of times, because I have a lot of computers around here, and for whatever reason I'll get lazy once in a while and just put any password, and it turns out I forget it, like, you know, 2 years later. So those are the tools that I know about, but others might have some other suggestions. Now, if you want to send us an email or an instant message or whatever, all my contact information and all of our contact information is in the show notes. You can also call us at 206-888-MAKE. That's a toll call, so make sure you are aware that there's going to be some charges. And that's 206-888-6253. That spells out MAKE. That's kind of funny. And we're going to be setting up a Skype email or Skype voicemail box soon, and you'll be able to call in and leave that. You can look for my IM and Skype and email contact information on the show notes, and I think that's it. So that's pretty much our first show for the Make Diecast. Let us know what you think, and you know, a lot of people have been asking if I'm going to be doing a show again, and I said yeah, and we got those interview series going. Those are almost ready to get out, but I got all the Lansing. I'm like, oh, you know what, we should start doing a show for folks who are, you know, driving and just want to listen to some do-it-yourself technology stuff and hacking and gadgety stuff, and you know, just things that are in my blog list or my email list. So hope you like it, and do let us know what you think, because we're always up for improving stuff. And for more information about Make Magazine and to subscribe, check out makezine.com. Our second issue will be out soon, and I promise to give you a lowdown on what's going to be in the second issue, and here's a list of some of the things that's going to be in there. Second issue is the home entertainment themed issue. We've got all sorts of stuff involving the broadcast flag, things from the guys who are doing life hacks, Tim O'Reilly's News from the Future, Made on Earth, a very interesting cockroach-controlled robot, a maker, Natalie Jeremijenko. If you follow the robots that find toxins, she is heading that up. Really, really, really neat stuff. We've got all sorts of Lego prototyping. We've got Google do-it-yourself patterns, photos and interviews from the Maker Faire, getting HDTV on your home computer. We've got the Atari 2600 PC project. Wait till you see this project. It's awesome. Podcasting 101, actually how to make your own podcast just like this. Mousy the Junk Bot, turning a mouse into a robot. This Old Amp, which is a neat, neat project to restore an old guitar amplifier and make it good or even better than it was to begin with. And then we've got R2 Do It Yourself. It's R2 DIY, and it's making your own Star Wars robots. And another how-tune, some reader input, the mobile section, which is just packed with tons of stuff, putting Linux on your iPod, and imaging, and portable FM transmitters and surround sound, and region-free DVDs, and all sorts of things. You've got to see this. The second issue, I like it better than the first. So do subscribe. All the information is on the site. And that's it. Thanks a lot.